This is Live Liminalist Stream. Keep getting that wrong, Liminal Radio. One of these days I'll work out exactly what this thing is called and what I'm doing here. But for now, I'm wrestling, thrashing around with the tentacles of technology. Okay, I'm getting some thumbs up there from the comments section. Thank God for that. I am raising my voice, speaking unnaturally loud, but I think that might be part of what I'm just going to have to do here. I think it's part of this getting into character business that I'm discovering the more I experiment with different media and notice how the message transforms. And that's one of the things I did want to talk about today, which was this whole business of who am I this time, which kind of ties in with the theme of today's show, which is what the hell is going on. And that's a question that I think is on everybody's minds now, one way or another. It probably already or always was, but I think that we live in this echo chamber of the global village, in which the noise of the signal keeps getting amplified, or the signal within the noise. I don't know what it is. It's the noise itself is a kind of signal. With just more and more of this echo of the global village coming back at us, and just how noisy it is and how hard it is to find the signal. So paradoxically, there's a kind of signal in that. And this question of what the hell is going on, as I was about to say, it has an inner and an outer aspect. I think that we've always throughout, well, ever since we developed self-consciousness through whatever kind of asteroid meteor strike trauma that hit us collectively, we've been wondering what the hell is going on internally. Like, who am I? Who am I today? Why do I feel the way I feel? Why do I not understand anything about human relationships or whatever else it is? You know, from a moment-to-moment basis, there's an existential crisis for many of us, certainly for myself. I don't know when my existential crisis began, nor do I know when it will end, but I do know that it's been pretty much consistent throughout my life. So there's that. And then there's the existential crisis on the outside, which is what's going on in the world. I mean, what the hell is going on in the world? And that never used to be so intense as it is today. They do say that every generation throughout history has felt that it was living in the end times, but I don't know if we can confirm that or not. We can confirm that this generation does, and the generation that I grew up in, as did, and my parents did, I suppose, a little bit. But anyway, of course, it depends on your religious orientation. There's lots of other factors, as far as the end time can mean many things, but in terms of just things being just too confusing to really make sense of, or just too much information to pass out and make a coherent narrative out of, I think it's probably safe to say that it's never been quite as bad as it is today, if for no other reason than we have access to far more information. But that's inseparable from the social media environment we're in, which is constant communication or failure to do so. Awareness of the failure to communicate. Anyway, all of this was a lead in to the thing that I was thinking about in terms of who am I when I do a radio show, which is what I'm pretending this is, even though it's internet, so there's no reason to really call it a radio show. I'm going to actually shut down over at YouTube. I think I've served the purpose. If you're listening to me on YouTube, please come over to Mixlr. I see there's 7 people and there's a whole bunch of comments. But yeah, there's no need to be feeding this into the AI cloud. So I'm going to end the stream on YouTube, and hopefully you've figured out how to come over to Mixlr. So bye to everyone there on YouTube. That was an interesting image I saw I had on YouTube, because I'd knocked the camera off the monitor. So hopefully there'll be a few extra numbers popping up on Mixlr now. Or they've just been cast into limbo forever. Anyway, where was I? I mean, some of you may have noticed that my voice and my delivery is a bit different, maybe quite a lot different on this Mixlr thing. And while listening to the test run a couple of days ago, Fräulein, who some of the more astute among you with Sherlock Holmes or at least Inspector Clouseau tendencies might be able to deduce who that would be, commented that I sounded a bit like Alan Partridge. And I've been watching Alan Partridge shows. There was a new season this time with Alan Partridge. It's Steve Coogan pretending to be a BBC DJ come TV presenter, and I wouldn't say I've followed Alan Partridge because I've only discovered him in the last few years, and actually he's been doing that shtick for I don't know how long, seems like 20 years or something, quite a long time. It's true that there does seem to be something going on with my DJ voice personality that is emulating Alan Partridge a little bit. But is that Steve Coogan or is that Alan Partridge? Alan Partridge doesn't really exist. And this is what occurred to me. Like, why would I want to emulate Alan Partridge? Why would I do that? Well, I think we're just inherently mimetic. And so some part of me, perhaps in mild desperation, while thrashing around in front of a microphone, trying to figure out how to manage the new medium, just naturally and instinctively went to a point of reference, a model to roll myself after. No, a role to model myself after. And because I'd just been watching Alan Partridge, it naturally went there. And so that's the short, simple explanation. But still, there must be something about Alan Partridge that I wanted to emulate. Can't simply, you know, I could have tried to be Jimmy Savile. I certainly hope that that wouldn't have happened. There must have been some affinity there with Alan Partridge. And it occurred to me that what's interesting or striking about Alan Partridge is he does not exist. So I'm emulating a fictional character. And what's curious there is that, I mean, what's even more curious is that if Alan Partridge did exist, I wouldn't want to be like him. He's not a kind of person that, well, I would admire or look up to or see as a suitable role model, unlike Dave O'Shaughnessy. And actually, that's true of Steve Coogan, too. I don't really like Steve Coogan that much. I mean, not really. I don't like it when he does those traveling things with that other guy and they go around restaurants and talk about the different food they eat. I find those quite obnoxious. And in other roles, also not particularly taken with Steve Coogan. I recognise his talent, but he's certainly not somebody I particularly admire. It's not like David Byrne or something like that. So what it has to be, I think, is the combination of Steve Coogan with the personality he's created, which is Alan Partridge. And the thing about Steve Coogan doing Alan Partridge is that he is using that as a persona to make fun of himself and to create a kind of, what is that? It's a zone in which self-consciousness gets cancelled out because, he doesn't have to be himself. But it's close enough to himself that he can sort of be himself without being self-conscious. So that, in a nutshell, is what I do with these things. This is why I'm, that's a way for me to kind of relax and get into it. Well, I can't just be myself because who is that anyway? I've got to be entertaining, I've got to come up with some sort of persona. So then I come up with a way of being an exaggerated version of myself, and I think that's what Steve Coogan's doing with Alan Partridge, which makes it so entertaining, is I feel like we're seeing Steve Coogan kind of more real than real. Like if he's, like Gibbs said in today's podcast, I was saying that actors are people who've learned to use the observer effect to their advantage. The observer effect is what we all experience, is that when we're being observed, we become self-conscious, we become super aware of what we're doing, and so that inhibits our behavior. So in other words, the observer affects the outcome of the experiment, as is recorded in quantum mechanics, extended to the realm of human relationships. When we watch somebody doing something, we're actually influencing the way they do it just by watching them, because theory of mind and all that, they become self-conscious. That's the observer effect. So actors are able to neutralize that because they have learned how to not be inhibited by the awareness of being observed. But as I pointed out to Gibb, they only do this by pretending to be someone else. When they have to be themselves and do interviews and stuff, they become self-conscious all over again, sometimes paralyzingly so, as in the case of somebody like Robert De Niro, who's one of the most interesting actors and one of the most boring human beings, so it's been said. I think it's generally true of actors in general. Sorry for the tautology there. That they're really not that interesting when they have to be themselves. So, I had a point to finish on there. I was hoping to finish on something, but I think I more or less summed up why I act weird on this thing, and hopefully I'll settle into it and to become a bit more myself while not losing the jerky, stilted, awkward English humour of Alan Partridge. Aha! So, I'm going to come back in a minute. I'm going to talk about Peter Sellers because I've been reading about him and I think it overlaps a bit with this. So in the meantime, here's the song. I hope. I could put the music up. I mean the volume up.
Been walking in the graveyard. Can't explain exactly why. Just like the way it looks. With a thank you.
You are listening to Liminal Radio coming live from Hope. I'm going to say that more often because Gib Strange tells me that politicians who use the word hope a lot in their presentations get more votes. And so there you have it. I am living in hope, and I might as well broadcast that fact. So, I was reading about Peter Sellers. I have been reading a Peter Sellers biography, and one of the things about Peter Sellers is that he himself claimed that he didn't exist, not in any quasi-enlightened sense, although he did. He was a spiritualist, and he did pursue various gurus and whatnot, but he never meant it that way. He just meant that he did not have any observable personality, and he couldn't find one, and he suffered because of that. He suffered a lot. He was a miserable bastard. He even felt that way about his face. He couldn't bear to look at his face because it was such a sort of potato, pudgy face with featureless kind of visage, and it distressed him. But of course, his ability to inhabit characters is inseparable from this apparent void at his own center, that he couldn't locate his own sense of identity, caused him enormous suffering in his life, throughout his life, and an early death, I would say. But as a result of that, he was not just able, but apparently driven, neurotically driven, to pretend to be other people and turn that into a consummate art form of impersonation or imitation. So once again, we have this example of finding relief in pretending to be someone else. And of course, I don't want to be pretending to be anyone else. And the aim of, you know, much of my output, in a certain sense, perhaps all of my output, has been to discover myself and to express it, to discover it in order to express it, but also to discover it by expressing it. So, of course, pretending is going to be counterproductive in that regard. And yet, if I wasn't already pretending, then there'd be no need to discover who I am. Because it's not as though I'm not expressing anything at all. I'm expressing from day one, and just trying to discover ways of expression that are more authentic and less stuttery. So then, the part of the solution, as I see it, or at least as I'm currently trying to interpret this strange involuntary possession by the spirit of a fictional character, Alan Partridge, is that I need to move from unconscious pretending to more conscious pretending, to become more conscious of pretending, partially by consciously pretending, which of course could be tricky, all kinds of traps in there, but better out than in, better to do something consciously than unconsciously. And perhaps in pretending, in acting out in certain ways and expressing in ways that are new and different and foreign, but sort of kind of impulsively natural because of mimesis and imitation and whatnot, I might discover the real thing. Of course, I've been exploring this with Dave Oshana. The best argument I know for the existence of enlightenment over there in Finland. And for those of you who think that enlightenment doesn't exist, and I know there are some of you, I have to say, well, all it means to me is a synonym for psychological wholeness. And if psychological wholeness did not exist, then by definition, psychological fragmentation or lack of wholeness would not exist either, because they could only be relative to something else. So clearly, just as inauthenticity exists, we know that to be true in our own experience on a daily basis, but of ourselves and of others, also authenticity must thereby exist. So it is with psychological wholeness and the lack of it. So that's all it really means to me is enlightenment. And well, one of the things that I think was going on over it when I was doing this on YouTube was that as a kind of defense or as a strategy to relieve my anxiety, I imitated Devashana a little bit. And the reason I would have done that is not merely or even primarily perhaps because I see him as a role model, because I don't think I imitate him particularly in my life in general, although I do refer to him a lot in my mind. But it would have been because I'd seen him do basically the same thing so many times on Zoom, doing a video presentation. So naturally I would go there, because if you've seen somebody do something and do something well, and you've seen them a lot, and then you try and do the same thing, then you're going to refer to that consciously or otherwise. So hence, I think, again, why I went back to Alan Partridge. Well, I went forward to Alan Partridge. So from Devashana to Alan Partridge, for those of you who are concerned that I might be falling into cult mentality, you can relax and rest assured that, I'm not. I mean, I just do it anyway all the time. We all do. We're always falling into mimetic patterns of behavior. It was kind of the point about today's podcast with Gib. We're all in a cult. We're all in many different cults and one larger cult. And it's all bound together by mimesis. Now, as to the question of why that is, I think that one of the obvious answers immediately is that lack of identity. And Marshall McLuhan said all forms of violence are quests for identity. Well, certainly, that's a provocative statement, although I think it's true. One would need to write a whole book to show that it was true. But if we were to say that all forms of imitation are sourced in a lack of identity, that would be pretty almost tautological and pretty self-explanatory. If we do not have a clear sense of who we are, we're going to look outside of ourselves for behaviors to imitate, because how else do we know how to behave if we don't have a core sense of self to act from? That's autonomy, or the lack thereof. So yes, the less of a clear sense of identity we have, both individually and collectively, perhaps, although this is a kind of a blurry line, really, because if we lack individual identity, then we do look to the group identity. So there must be some kind of collective identity. But how does it form if we're talking about a collective that consists of individuals who lack a sense of identity? What kind of group identity forms out of that collective? I'd like to be able to think of a metaphor now, but unfortunately, my right brain is underdeveloped there. But it's like, I can't do it. It's basically mashing a whole bunch of things together that you hope that will, you know, come together into a structured, coherent thing. But because they're all mushy, they just come into a blob. The blob. We have the blob. The Borg. Which identity is a negative identity. It's merely a craving to exist. And I think that the collective identity is a collective craving to exist or be real, because a collective identity is the sum of the parts of these many myriad individual identities that are individually craving to be real, which brings me back to Peter Sellers. Now, why did Peter Sellers crave to be real and, you know, find that the only way he could do that was by pretending to be someone else? How did that happen? Well, the answer appears to be that he had a very possessive mother who, on the hand, lived vicariously through him and gave him no autonomy whatsoever, and on the other hand, somewhat paradoxically, treated him like a king whose every whim was to be granted. And it's interesting how those two things can go together, and you see how they would, because if a mother wishes to possess her child, and live vicariously through him, thereby stripping him of any possibility of autonomy, she would also want to act out all of her whims through him, and thereby give him absolute power as a vessel, receptacle for her own unconscious drives. That's a scary scenario I'm painting now, and if you have ever read a biography of Peter Sellers, or the one that I'm reading, which is by Roger Lewis, that it really is a scary scenario. One of the world's most famous funny men lived a life of nightmarish despair and distress and misery and fear, which does beg the question of, well, how funny is the stuff that we're enjoying and imbibing that was the result of that nightmarish existence? It's not very funny, is it? So we're laughing at somebody's misery and despair, not directly, we're laughing at their coping mechanisms, the way that they learn to cope with anguish and despair of psychic enmeshment with the mother. And in the case of Peter Sellers, it went to the archetypal extremes of actually being in touch with his mother, or rather being under her control, under her guidance, and now Whitley Strieber's coming to mind, after she died, because Peter Sellers was into seances and stuff. He made daily contact with what he believed was his mother, often on the telephone, talking to mediums who would relay over the telephone, probably a whole bunch of hucksters and charlatans taking advantage of a demented celebrity with loads of money. But nonetheless, by this method, the late Peter Sellers, who could be listening in right now for all we know, he believed he received guidance and instructions from his mother. And these included the most demented things. Peter Sellers was one of the most difficult actors in the history of cinema. He could not tolerate the color purple. He did not tolerate the color green. That's just starting with the most trivial, but obviously the most problematic, because the whole sets had to be destroyed in order to cater to his superstitious needs, and so on. He was possessed by a myriad of whims and fears and anxieties, many or most of which were sourced in his relationship with his mother, and that literally manifested in a symbiotic, codependent enmeshment from beyond the grave, which, as I say, does correspond rather chillingly with Whitley Strieber, who has said that he felt his mother's presence after she died, and is now co-writing books with his dead wife, who he sees as his guru and his higher self. Well, not literally his higher self. Oh dear, what a tangled web we do weave. And so, look at it this way, friends and listeners. All of the output that you're getting to enjoy from me may very well be similar to the late, not so great, and very sad Peter Sellers, an ongoing quasi-creative attempt by your host, Living in Hope, Jason Horsley, for Liminal Radio, to extricate himself from the psychic morass of my mother's existence. I don't know. I mean, certainly that's some of what's going on, I know. And I think that is very inextricably entwined with the difficulty that I have, or the determination I have, let's put a positive spin on it, to discover my authentic voice via these various media, to disentangle my life force from the psychic tentacles of maternal enmeshment. And now we're going to have a song. Let's see what it is and if it speaks to this situation. Okay, so that was Lee Madiford, I'll Take My Leave. Did seem kind of appropriate. This is what my wife used to call the radio song, and it was something that we explored together, we played together, while we were first getting to know each other online, long distance, across the Atlantic Ocean, one of them anyway. And that was that. She would ask questions while listening to Mystic Radio, something like that, on Live 365. And she would read the song that came next as the answer to the question. And she would give me two things via this method. She would give me a kind of information or input or insight about my struggles, which were directly related to psychic enmeshment with my mother at that time. That was the first project that my wife and I embarked upon, long before we knew that where it was leading for us personally, although we might have guessed. And the other thing it provided, of course, was songs that I did not know about. PJ Harvey, Damien Rice, Blood Group, Indigo Girls. Anyway, a bunch of music that I discovered via this game that my wife would play. And it occurs to me that this is perhaps a healthier equivalent of seances and trying to talk to the dead and whatnot. The thing about the dead is that they are speaking to us all of the time. They are communicating to us through everything. And we don't quite know how or why that works. Well, maybe we know why a bit better, but we certainly don't know how. And it would be difficult to distinguish or separate the internal communications from our ancestors and other dead, I presume. Sam Hyde is here today, and we've talked together about the way in which I feel connected, psychically entangled with Sam Peckinpah, even though I don't believe he was an ancestor. So it does seem to extend to the whole human family. But I think most strongly and specifically with ancestors, they would be communicating with us internally through our genetics, obviously our impulses and our desires and our patterns of behavior. They're all running internally through our viscera, and those are all extensions of those who went before us. but there may be an external element too. And that presumably could come through anything and everything, including technology, but also including other human beings. Like when my wife was guiding me away from enmeshment with my mother through her own innate wisdom and compassion and interest, including self-interest in a good way, I think, she may well have been passing on messages from my ancestors without being conscious of doing so. I was talking to Gibbs Strange this week, who may or may not be listening, about EVP, electric voice phenomena, and how apparently, I know Whitley would be a strong believer in this kind of thing, but I did meet somebody who contacted me because they believed that their dead wife had told them to, about Matrix Warrior, and I went to visit him in Wales, and he played the recordings that he believed included messages from his dead wife. I was not 100% convinced. But anyway, that the dead are able to somehow use digital technology to get through to us, and the more advanced our technology becomes, the more sophisticated, the more it's able to pick up subtler signals from the other side, suggesting indeed that the consciousness that extends beyond the life of the body does have some physical component to it. It's just much subtler, and that thereby the subtle communications from the other side require more subtler instrumentalities to pick them up. Now, none of this is new, but what was new was that the whole thing about artificial intelligence and how it may be taking over not just society but human beings has a very sinister aspect to it, and it's generally seen as not a good thing. But it might be that it's really not either or, neither good nor bad, but just something that's inevitably occurring. And in fact, I mean, for example, the example that Gib and I used was dating sites, and how people are blindly passing over what was once the subtle influence of the fairy folk or our ancestors to guide us to the right partner, handing it over to digital algorithms created by cynical corporations, and how that can only be a bad thing. But on the other hand, if our ancestors and even the mysterious fairy folk are able to make use of this technology, the more sophisticated it becomes, the closer it infringes upon their realm, the more they have access to our realm through that technology, then theoretically, eventually these evil algorithms could be rendered in service of God himself. So there's a positive spin for you. I feel as though I was on my way to something else there, but I don't remember what it was. So I won't try, but I know it relates to mother enmeshment. There's a comment here from Sam Hyde, I'm going to read it, and just also as a reminder to others that much more than the YouTube environment, where I did tend to go into a spoken word essay and not really want to be interrupted, this format is much more conducive to comments and questions. So Oswald Spengler, for example, I know that you like to throw in questions that were totally unrelated to anything and over on YouTube, and I rarely got to them. Well, on this format, that would be much more suitable, because I'm constantly looking for new inspiration. Anyway, Sam Hyde said, seems like this description of Salah's personal quirks and inner battles mirrors how antisocial the shaman can be. Some parallel about the cost of tapping into the other side. Well, autist too, I suppose, and that's a positive spin again. I think that perhaps the shaman idea has become quite debased in our culture, just as the word spiritual has, and so we can think of someone like Peter Sellers as a shaman, or Whitley Strieber for that matter, no matter how personally damaged they are. And but simply because they do have some access to cities and to spirit realms and so on and so forth, although I'm not sure if Peter Sellers did. Maybe that was part of his ability to assume other personalities so well. Maybe he was actually being possessed, but in any event, I don't think that there was anything in Peter Sellers' life, unless it perhaps be the gift of laughter, that could be considered healing. And I'm not very sure about Willy Strieber either, as you know. And a shaman, to me, I mean, if it means anything, it means a healer. And well, that's a very rare capacity, I think, that of healer. And I have a habit of saying "and when I'm not sure what to say next, and it's problematic, because if I don't know what I'm going to say next, there's a good chance that I don't have anything to say next. So rather than "and I should learn to just allow for dead air. All right, so I did get a question or a comment from Mari H on Facebook yesterday, so I'm going to go over to that one and see. It's about anger. Is there ever any justification for feeling angry, hurt, or undervalued, or is it just ego trauma? Does Dave get hurt? Well, there's certainly, I mean, we don't need justification to get hurt. If we're hurt, we're hurt. And yes, I've seen Dave express an experience of being hurt. I don't know if it's particularly a good idea to refer to Dave or to anyone as some sort of benchmark and say, well, do they experience this and they're enlightened? But if we look at, as I said, the notion of enlightenment as psychological wholeness, and we say that, or if I say that Dave is the person that seems to be most psychologically whole and may even be psychologically whole, at least makes a case for that being possible and attainable, does that include the capacity to be hurt? Yes, absolutely, based on my experience of Dave and my own experience. Like, the more psychologically whole I've become, I would say that I've become more aware of my capacity to be hurt. And I think, I mean, one of the accusations I've had recently, I think I mentioned it, I don't remember now if it was on a public event or not, but anyway, was of being thin-skinned. No, it was a private one. And I do think I've become more thin-skinned in a certain sense. But thin skins could have at least two meanings, just as the word sensitive can be used in two different ways. It can be sensitivity. Now I've tangled myself up, haven't I? It can mean an ability to feel thin-skinned, very sensitive to one's own feelings, let's say, or it can be reactive. And reactive is when a feeling of being hurt turns into a feeling of anger. And that can happen so fast that we're not even aware of being hurt, we're just aware of becoming angry. And I would say that that's an example of when anger is not useful or helpful. And I also think that that's probably most of the time that we get angry. It's because we feel hurt, rejected, undervalued, and so on. I think there are reasons to be angry in life. I know there are. And that anger is a necessary capacity within us. Anyway, I'm not sure that I can say more to that question. I think it's probably too much like the kind of question that a person asks a teacher, even a spiritual teacher, or even a guru. and absolutely kills the Alan Partridge in me. I mean, I'd just make fun of that kind of question, but that's not the kind of guy I am either. So I don't know. I mean, if you're hurt and you know it, show it. And if you're angry, don't try to hide it. Just let it out. It's usually pretty embarrassing. It's actually one of the funny things about Alan Partridge is that he, the character, is always trying to cover up his emotions and his awkwardness and his discomfort. And it's those efforts that he makes to cover up what's really going on, I think, that is a source of a lot of humour there. So that's kind of a third layer, because you've got Alan Partridge is Steve Coogan's way of actually showing sides of himself that he's afraid to normally show. And yet, central to that is this personality, Alan Partridge, who is himself clearly afraid of showing parts of himself. And so Steve Coogan, through Alan Partridge, is letting that part of himself show, which is the part that's afraid to let parts of himself show. Isn't that ironic? Because if we were just not afraid of letting parts of ourselves show, then we would nullify the part of ourselves that we're most afraid of people seeing, which is the part that's afraid, the part that's self-conscious, inhibited, and that's pretending and dissembling and putting forward a fake persona. And yeah, I think the reason I like Steve Coogan less than Alan Partridge is Alan Partridge seems more real to me than Steve Coogan. Steve Coogan's quite smooth and confident and sure of himself. He's Steve Coogan, right? Whereas Alan Partridge, aha, is a bit of a loser, really, and everybody knows it. Even he knows it. That's the really painful thing. Like, he's trying so hard to big himself up and make himself seem like more than he is, that even he can see it, and he knows everyone else can see it, but he can't actually stop doing it. It's quite sad, really. Tragic. Pathos. That's where humour is. So I guess that's why I love Alan Partridge, because I feel for him. Don't feel that way for Steve Coogan. Feel like he's pretending and doesn't know it. Okay, Heather Kay said, I wonder about the vulnerability, hurtability, aliveness connection. If we can interrupt the hurt to anger machine and just tolerate the discomfort of the hurt, that feels healthier to me than jumping straight to outrage, separate from pure anger, which also feels healthy. It's the twisting of the original thing into something else that feels dysfunctional. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Just, I think we do harm to ourselves when we sell ourselves short like that. We feel that we can't afford to show what's really going on, so we've got to quickly co-opt that with a cover story, and then put the cover story forward, and then we get locked into that. So, I mean, for me, I suppose it is a bit similar to the Alan Partridge, Steve Coogan thing. For me, what life has become more and more, at least in terms of handling neuroses and negative emotions and stuff, it's been a willingness to ham it up a bit, to express my negativity in a way that is self-indulgent, but knowingly, consciously so. So, and what occurs very often in my domestic life, my life with my wife, living here in Hope, as I do, is that it's kind of passive aggressive, but it's also something else. I will make a joke that's really indistinguishable from a complaint, but it's because I want to express my irritation or my hurt or whatever. But I also know that it's kind of beneath me, but I don't want to just let the superego override the id. So then I try and get them to work together, and I get the id to make fun of the superego, while the superego kind of polices the id at the same time, because that's what they do with each other. And so what you get is this weird thing where I'll come out and I'll say something like, Well, that was pretty stupid, wasn't it? And I actually am thinking that was really stupid, but I'm also thinking you shouldn't say that. That's not fair, and that's not how you see this person. You don't see them as stupid just because they did something stupid, and so on, right? So I'll say it, and I'm making fun of myself, but I'm also getting a dig in at the other person. So I get to have my psychic cake and eat it. I get to indulge my neuroses while at the same time fessing up that they are neuroses and that I am trying, honey, to move beyond them. And well, it's a bit of a razor's edge, isn't it? But I think it works. I think it does work. I think I do the similar in the thrift store as well. Like, I'll act grumpy. I'll let the grumpiness show, so that I myself can see it and the customers can see it too, but at least they see that I'm not trying to hide it. Don't we feel more comfortable with someone who's actually letting stuff show rather than the tension that they're trying to hide something? We can't even imagine that it's even worse than it is. Like, if somebody's annoyed with us and they hide it, then they must really be annoyed with us. Whereas if they show, they think, okay, well, at least they're showing it, at least they respect and care for us enough to want to communicate. If they're suppressing it, it's like, well, they've already given up on us. I mean, that's part of it. There's a lot of variables, a lot of layers. Marie says, if we don't exist, who is hurt? Well, that's a good question. I mean, I didn't say we don't exist. I just said that Alan Partridge doesn't exist, and yet I like him more than Steve Coogan, who does exist. And I said that I'm always pretending to be someone anyway, so let's make that more conscious. Well, as I said, I'm only pretending because I don't have a core sense of self because of psychic enmeshment with the mother. That doesn't mean there isn't a core self. I'm on not on the fence there. I'm liminal. I don't know. I don't know if there's a core self. I know there's a body, and I suspect there's a soul. I think that the soul is probably, by definition, not an individual, not a separate sentience, the way that the body can be experienced as a separate sentience. Maybe the soul can be experienced as a separate sentience too, but that might not be optimal. It may not be optimal for the body either. I don't know. I mean, I was going to say try and have sex, but for many of us, maybe it is a trying. We try, or we succeed, we have sex. We're trying to merge with the other. I mean, not necessarily, but I think the optimal experience of sex does seem to involve a merging where the pleasures, one's own pleasure becomes indistinguishable from the pleasure of the other. I'm feeling a bit of lewd Alan Partridge energy now, which I'm just going to let be there. Not try and ham it up, because that would be awkward and ungainly. So that's an optimal experience of being physical, I think, for many of us, at least the idea of it, but probably experientially too, having sex in an intimate, loving way that's very mutual, is an optimal physical experience. And in that experience, we kind of lose a sense of the boundaries between our body and the body of the other. So I think with souls, that would certainly be true, that our experience of who we are as a soul self is not possible without a growing awareness or a core awareness, innate awareness of the permeability of sentience, to use a phrase that I coined some time ago, permeable sentience, that deepening sentience entails deepening awareness of permeability and vice versa. The more permeable we become as awareness, the deeper our awareness can grow. It's expansion, man. We're expanding into the universe. I'm not going to say and now. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to play another song. Sweet
Standing tall, facing the sun, your silhouette is on fire. Standing tall, confronting the sun, your silhouette is on fire. Spread your wings, take a deep breath with heart and soul. Fly, fly. Spread your wings, take a deep breath with heart and soul. Fly, fly, fly.
Okay, this is a test. Can you hear me? This is Liminal Radio coming to you live from Hope, Jason Horsley. I have to say my name there, because that's who I'm pretending to be. But whenever I say it, I do wonder, is that really who I am? I don't even know how to pronounce my name properly. Jason Horsley. Jason Horsley. Jason Horsley. Jason Horsley. Jason Horsley. This is Liminal Radio. This is Jason Horsley coming to you live from Hope. Still looking for things to talk about. I'm just going over a book, an unpublished book currently, that I've been working on for many, many years. It's mutated over the years into various different things. Started out as a book about autism, which I think was called Perceptual Warfare initially. And it was one of the first thing I was working on the blog, Autoculture, and it was going to be a three-part book. And part one was autism, and the other that was serialized at the blog. Part two was what was it called? Don't remember now, but this is what I've got now is part two of that book has become part one of this other book, which is called Neurodeviant for now, although I think it's going to be a different title eventually. Techno Logos was one I had in mind for it. Where Nature and Artifice Meet is the subtitle currently. Technology and Consciousness Intersect. That seems to be the general theme of it. And it's currently three books. The first part, as I said, was from this unfinished book on autism, which is about neurodeviance, perception, consciousness, Philip K. Dick, and stuff like that. Part two is a novel that I wrote, which was also called Neurodeviant for a while, and is now called Original Syntax. And that novel is also about autism, about mind control, things of that sort. And then part three is The Kubricon, which was the other book I was working on. So essentially it's the remains of three books which I couldn't finish, which I'm now trying to complete as a single book. And I don't know if I can. So here's an example of me trying to figure out what the hell is going on and make sense of the world. And this is how I described it in an email that I sent to Zizek the other day, yesterday even, who I just realized, I just found out, had, well, right after I sent the email, embarked on, I think, a 7-hour debate with Jordan Peterson, which I'm going to have to listen to. So it was pretty bad timing on my part, because Zizek couldn't possibly be more distracted than right now. I mean, before that event, obviously during, and now after, I'm sure he's getting loads of kudos and whatnot. I hear that he wiped the floor with Jordan Peterson, although I imagine that Jordan Peterson followers feel differently, or at least would want to argue otherwise. But anyway, this is what I said to Slavov. I'm working on a mystery, and our work and your work has been one of many reference points that has helped me navigate the increasingly disorienting intersection we are located at between consciousness, culture, technology, ideology, language, metaphysics, and nature, human and otherwise. One of the ways I approach the question of what it means to be human is by talking to other humans, preferably the sentient sort. To do it, then I suggest possible subjects, which include the Procrustean potential of language to imprison thought inside ideology, how advances in technology, especially internet and social media related, are evolving or devolving culture and consciousness faster than we can adapt, and what is epigenetically emerging out of that unholy marriage. Obviously, I tried to be as highbrow as possible with Zizek, because I figure he responds to convoluted, complex sentences. Anyway, so that, yeah, that's the problem that I've been working on. Now, is it a problem? Well, it's not exactly a mathematical problem, but we could say it's a philosophical problem. Is it a practical problem? I don't know. I mean, I suppose in terms of how and if we use social media, the internet, and other technologies, it is, in terms of understanding what it is that's happening here, what the hell is going on. Is it necessary to understand that? No, probably not. But is there a cost for not understanding? I would say undoubtedly. Now, there are different kinds of understanding. There's a kind of understanding that does allow us to navigate better the climate that we're in, and then there's a kind of understanding that doesn't, that just gives us the false sense of security of understanding, and thereby perpetuates complacency and ignorance. That's an ironic paradox, isn't it? Understanding that perpetuates ignorance. probably it would be illusory understanding. And one of the problems that I'm addressing here, but also faced with, is how illusory is my understanding? How do we map the distinction? How do we even locate the distinction between consciousness and culture, between metaphysical reality, physical reality, psychological reality, delusion, which is also psychological reality, but a psychological defense against reality, and what was the last one I was going to say? Oh, damn, I've lost it. What was I going to say? Did I say technology? I guess software, the simulations of, or the interferences of technology itself. Now, my real interest, well, not my real interest, but the thing that keeps me poking away at this, or digging away like a time team trying to find clues to what's going on here, even though I'm really trying to discover the future rather than the past, but by looking into the past, what really keeps capturing my attention is the question of technology and culture. So the external extensions of consciousness as we perceive them and as we interact with them. So first of all, it's culture, it's pop culture, which I've had a lifelong fascination with, and I just keep coming back to, hence the Kubrickon. And then secondly, it's technology, and movies, you could say, are the most technologically dependent of art forms. Writing, in theory, and perhaps in practice, could happen without any technology at all. One could write with one's finger in the sand. Painting, likewise, one can paint on leaves with you know, the juice of insects or what have you. Like they did face paint, when they did face paint, and Jason Wilcox talked about this and thing, different types of earth or clay or whatever they used to paint their faces. That's the beginning, that's body art. Again, no technology required. Music, likewise, we can sing, no technology. What are the other art forms? Sculpture, same, just clay, no technology. I think that's it, isn't it? More or less, I think I've covered most of the bases, isn't it? But then suddenly we have movies. I mean, it wasn't really sudden, because of course we had the printing press, we had all these other developments by which art forms did become technology dependent, and they mutated as a result. But movies, photography, and then movies, of course recorded things like this, came out of the technology. So what does that mean? I don't know. I'm just observing it for the first time, that my interest in technology and my interest in pop culture, they converge there and they become one. And my explanation refers to the ways in which both technology and culture and the arts have both map, describe, diagnose, and exacerbate the symptoms of dissociation and the escape into fantasy narratives. And this is proliferating now to the point that we have created a whole alternate universe, matrix-like, of the internet and social media, in which more and more we are diverting our life force into. And of course, again, inseparable from the technology, as we put our lives, our energy, our time, our consciousness into the technology by spending more and more time on the internet, as we're doing now, the more the technology spills out into our lives. We breathe it in, then we breathe it out through the physical extensions of the human body, being the iPhones, the smartphones, the headsets, the Google Glasses, the technological implants. Now, all of this, we know what's happening. It seems inevitable, and we all feel disoriented and confused by it. Well, maybe not all of us. A lot of us. I think we all do, whether we're conscious of it or not. So, what rough beast is being born from this unholy union of flesh and artifice? That's the question that I'm asking. That's the problem that I wish to solve, because I think it's a problem that we're going to have to realize anyway. I don't know about solve. It may be that it's solving itself simply by happening. Like, the Star Child is an android. It is an insentient artifice that is possessed by the human unconscious will, whether it's mother, whether it's father, whether it's child. Of course, the mother and the father exist in and as the child. But the artificial star child is the child of human consciousness and endeavor and machine. So I guess the machine is the mother. Well, I don't know. I don't even know how to unravel that one. But dot dot dot. Yeah, so you can see why I haven't finished the book anyway, I imagine. So that's what I'm working on currently. And actually, one of the initial impeti, that's plural of impetus, for doing the Zoom, YouTube, and now Mixler meetups was to work on this project. Like, initially, that's why I contacted Gib and started doing weekly conversations with Gib, because I thought I could bring more people into the mix. I thought together we could work out this problem, work on it, work it out. I'd be able to finish the book, and something else would come out of it too, the collaboration and the synergy of a shared focus on something deeply, deeply mysterious that affects us all. The nature of existence as it's revealing itself to us via the technological dystopia that we're creating. A nightmarish resolution to history. How do we wake from the dream? By the dream moving all the way into nightmare. By the unconscious, the id, the Hyde side of Dr. Jekyll, as he frantically experiments in his laboratory, that's the collective laboratory of the global village, the Hyde side emerges and reveals itself. And that we see that which we've disowned. Is it the world of the dead? Is it our own souls? Is it our own unconscious? Is it a hidden conspiracy? Is it aliens? Is it all or none of the above? It's the singularity, man. Anyway. So that's my summation of the project that I'm working on. If there is any interest at all, then I'll probably keep working on it. Oh, Sam Hyde says, High Life, saw High Life, which I just downloaded to watch. Still processing it. Like if Interstellar was on a prison ship with MK Ultra experiments. Good. I didn't like Interstellar. I turned it off. But those other bits sound good. I definitely thought it looked interesting. So yeah, it should be grist for the mill. Maybe a little bit of inspiration too. So this has been going for an hour and a half, 1 hour 30. Of course, the first 10 minutes were a bust. But that makes an hour 20 minutes. That's the time frame I had for a YouTube thing. With Mixler Radio, I think I can... Well, do it perhaps more impulsively and randomly. That depends if there are enough followers and if enough people show up, but there's a good chance that I'm just going to do little radio streams, live streams, kind of at random. I'll keep up this one on Saturday mornings. I'm still wanting to organize the live meets on Zoom. Now, they could still follow on from this. They could even occur simultaneously with this, as in I could be on Zoom now and people could be signed in and watching this as well as listening. Or, as I say, they could just follow on. We could go from this to a Zoom meeting. I think not today. Two reasons. One, it's a very nice sunny day, so I think I want to enjoy that. Although, of course, that's going to be the case more and more as summer comes on. But the other reason is that I don't think there's enough people who have shown interest as yet. There's been a couple of sign-ups, and I'm still ironing out the wrinkles for that at the website. I think it's all ironed out now. So if you're interested in live YouTube events, all you need to do is sign up over at the website in the widget bar on the right hand side of any page beside the home page. It says to attend live Liminalist events, sign up here. So just do that. Also, if you want updates for live stream radio, I think the only way really is to follow me on Mixlr. And do encourage you to do that, because that will encourage me to do this more than anything else. There's knowing you're out there. It's been 13 listeners today. That's less than on YouTube. We have lost some men and women in the transition. They went overboard. They did not get in the life raft. But that's okay. I feel this way about other things too. If somebody's not willing to sacrifice their attachment to YouTube and make a little bit of effort to just go over to a different app, then probably they're beyond saving. I'm being a bit ironic, but I'm also being 100% serious. And this is 50% serious. Jason Horsley coming live from Hope for Liminal Radio on Saturday, Good Saturday, the 20th of April 2019. And this is a song from I don't know who. Symbol.